headlines this hour. Iran and Russia begin joint naval drills north of the Indian Ocean aimed at establishing security for international trade. U.S. lawmakers plan to establish an independent commission to probe the January attack on the Capitol by supporters of then-President Donald Trump. And a severe winter storm hits the U.S., killing at least four people and leaving millions without power. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Iran and Russia have launched joint naval maneuvers in the north of the Indian Ocean. The maneuvers involve naval and air units of the Navy of the Iranian Army, as well as the Navy of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. A Russian frigate, a logistical warship, and helicopters are also taking part. The military exercises are aimed at honing the skills of both countries' naval troops and ensuring maritime security. The drills come to boost security for international maritime trade and to increase capabilities to tackle piracy and terrorism at sea. Among other objectives is to exchange experience on naval aid and rescue operations. The exercises are carried out across an area spanning 17,000 square kilometers. Iran's envoy to the International Atomic Energy Agency has officially informed the UN body of Tehran's decision to end voluntary implementation of the additional protocol. Now, this means that Iran will not give IAEA broader access to its sites or allow snap inspections as of next week. Homolesky reports.
Iran has informed the International Atomic Energy Agency it plans to stop taking voluntary measures that give the agency broader access under the so-called additional protocol. Iran has been implementing the additional protocol voluntarily as part of its commitments under the nuclear deal with world powers known as the JCPOA.
I have delivered a letter from the government of the Islamic Republic of Iran to the Director General of the IAEA specifying that as of 23rd February 2021, Iran will stop all voluntary measures beyond its safeguard commitments as envisaged in the JCPOA.
Kazem Gharibabadi said as of February 23rd, cooperation between Iran and the IAEA would be based solely on the country's safeguards agreement with the agency. If U.S. sanctions are effectively lifted, he added, Iran would resume implementation of all voluntary measures. The decision is in line with a law approved by the Iranian parliament almost 2 months ago, obliging the government to reduce IAEA access and step up nuclear enrichment if U.S. sanctions are not lifted, specifically those imposed against Iranian oil exports and the country's banking system. The previous U.S. administration under President Donald Trump reimposed the sanctions as part of a maximum pressure policy after withdrawing from the nuclear deal in 2018. Meanwhile, Iran has also informed the IAEA of its serious concerns over the protection of confidential information. In an official letter, Iran has asked the agency to revise its policies in order to avoid the far too common instances of IAEA reports being leaked to the media via unauthorized access, potentially threatening the country's national security. Since it was implemented in 2016, the nuclear deal has given the IAEA unprecedented access to Iranian nuclear sites. But that level of cooperation would inevitably come to an end if efforts to revive the JCPOA fail. Homolesky, Vienna.
Washington has called for an investigation into a rocket attack on a military facility of U.S.-led forces in northern Iraq. The Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, said the U.S. is outraged by the attack that hit Erbil International Airport in Iraq's Kurdistan region. He said the U.S. supports all efforts to hold accountable those responsible. At least three rockets were fired at the airport. One hit the U.S.-led forces complex, killing a foreign contractor and wounding six others, including an American soldier. Iraq's premier has called for a probe into the attack. President Barham Saleh slammed it as dangerous and criminal. He said it undermined steps taken to safeguard Iraq's security. John Stepling is an author and commentator joining us from Inderoy. We're looking at perhaps one of the major decisions that the U.S. has to make when it comes to Iraq in terms of the nature of this incident, which is an attack on U.S.-led forces. What type of reaction may we see from the U.S. on this?
Well, this is one of those questions. I mean, look at how long the U.S. has been in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in the entire region. How many times there have been these isolated or not even isolated series of bomb attacks or something. And there are press conferences, and American politicians say they're outraged and stamp their feet and wring their hands, and nothing much ever changes, and nothing much is going to change here. What's interesting is that, you know, Biden, when he was vice president, was famous for encouraging a light footprint, what he called a light footprint militarily. That meant drone attacks and special forces. And there's no reason to think any of that has changed. That's going to be, I think, the template. The people he has surrounded himself with are all hawks. Anthony Blinken, Wendy Sherman, who was tutored by Madeleine Albright, Jake Sullivan, Victoria Nuland, who was once foreign policy advisor to Dick Cheney. These people are all interventionists and aggressive hawks, and Biden has, you know, a long-standing and very close relationship with the defense industry. And now the Secretary of Defense is a former Raytheon executive. So what we're going to see are a lot of cosmetic changes and not much else. There will be no troops brought back. They will be shuffled around, the deck will be reshuffled, and it may look slightly different. But the U.S. is not going to leave the region. They're already bringing more troops into Syria. The fact that this bomb attack happened in a region referred to as Kurdistan is perhaps moderately interesting. The other factor is a civilian contractor was among the fatalities, and this is the U.S., you know, war machine is increasingly privatized, so we're going to see more of that. But in terms of what the response will be, you know, probably not much of anything. Biden has always prided himself on having close relationships with foreign leaders, especially the more corrupt ones. He was very close with al-Maliki. He was instrumental in getting Haider put in after Maliki. He's close with Poroshenko, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so, you know, he has a lot of experience, and he will massage the optics to make it seem as though he is the new voice of sanity, where Trump was the image of, you know, insanity. But in truth, he's going to be a more aggressive foreign policy president than Trump was, certainly. And he's a arch Russophobe. He's really has always been Russophobic, and I think we're going to see a ratcheting up of rhetoric against Russia. But you know, Iran will be blamed for this attack. That's a given. What that means in terms of, you know, the short term reaction is hard to say, but I don't think it will be anything significant. This is optics, and the U.S. will you know, wax outraged and indignant, but that's what they always do. That's what they've done for 20 years in this region, if not much longer. And so it's just more of the same. And frankly, it's, you know, it becomes very tedious at a certain point. We know what the U.S. does. We know what their intentions are.
And finally, do you think, John Stepling, that VP Biden, who before, when he was VP, I should say, had floated around the idea about Iraq being partitioned into three sections based on the religious ethnicity, as he had stated, and that it would remain under a central government, but the control would be actually shared between, for example, the three semi-autonomous regions. Do you think that plan is something still in the mind of now the current president, Biden? Or is that just something that was in the past and not something that he would think of applying now?
I think they'll test the waters for that. I mean, that idea has been floated a number of times, various versions of it. You know, it's useful to remember that the U.S. still thinks of itself really as a colonial power. So partitioning regions and bringing in, you know, Western viceroys to oversee the heathens. You know, that's really how they think of this stuff. And as outrageous as that idea may seem, I don't think it's unimaginable at all. But like I say, they will test drive it in the public for the public and see what the reaction is, and that will determine what happens probably, because that's the bottom line never changes. It's just the presentation that changes.
Thank you very much for that. John Stepling, author and commentator there from Inderoy. Moving on, Israeli forces have raided several neighborhoods in the occupied West Bank and arrested a dozen Palestinians. According to Palestinian media, the raids took place early on Tuesday morning. They say that Israeli soldiers attacked Palestinian houses in the cities of Nablus, Ramallah, and Al-Khalil, also known as Hebron. Two members of Hamas resistance movement were among the detainees. Israeli troops frequently attack Palestinian homes in occupied territories and arrest people. Most of them are jailed under the regime's so-called administrative detention. That allows the imprisonment of Palestinians for an indefinite period without charge or trial. Mona Condil is a correspondent who joins us from occupied Ramallah. Tell us the reason for the raid and what was the outcome of what Israel has done, which is something that happens frequently.
Well, that's right. The Israeli forces are used to raid West Bank areas, villages and towns, cities on a daily basis. But what was going on in the recent days, according to observers, that a number of Palestinians affiliated with the Hamas movement, or even leaders and senior figures of the Hamas movement, have been detained across the occupied West Bank. Several days ago, arrests had taken place in the city of Jenin. Today, two senior Hamas figures were detained. One of them is a former Palestinian prisoner, Adnan Asfour, and was taken from the village of Al-Mahfiyi in Nablus, northern the occupied West Bank. The other Palestinian is a former Hamas parliamentarian, Sheikh Yasser Mansour, and was detained from the village of Zawata. Also, some two dozens Palestinians were arrested by the Israeli forces this morning in several areas of the occupied West Bank. The majority of the detentions had taken place in the town of Silwad near Ramallah. Now, some experts are saying that these detentions and against Hamas leaders could be an attempt by the Israeli regime to prevent the Palestinian elections, as the Palestinian elections would be taking place, are scheduled in the legislative elections on May 22, and then the presidential polls on July 31st. These are the first elections in 15 years, and Hamas movement, as well as the different political factions, would be taking place in these elections. Even Hamas officials have warned that Israel would be planning to stage mass arrest campaign against what they said the resistance group ahead of the Palestinian elections. And this is actually is being translated on ground from these arrests.
Very well, thank you for that. We appreciate it, Mona. Mona Condil, our correspondent, talking to us from occupied Ramallah. Moving on, U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says lawmakers will establish an outside independent commission to review last month's insurrection on the Capitol. Pelosi said in a letter to lawmakers that the commission would be modeled on a similar one convened after the 9/11 attacks in 2001. She added that the commission will review the facts and causes related to the deadly Capitol raid by supporters of then-President Donald Trump. This comes after the Senate acquitted Trump on impeachment charges of inciting the attack on the Congress building on January the 6th. An unprecedented winter storm has hit large parts of the U.S., battering at least two dozen states. Texas, Kentucky, Mississippi, Oregon, and Oklahoma are among those affected states. Four people have already been killed in storm-related incidents. The National Weather Service says that 150 million are under winter weather advisories. The storm has disrupted transportation also. It has caused power outages as demand for electricity has surged. In Texas alone, more than 4 million people have been left without electricity. President Joe Biden has approved the state of emergency there. The storm is forecast to continue on Tuesday. Protests against junta leaders are expanding in Myanmar as military rulers ratchet up security measures against demonstrators. Railway staff in the largest city, Yangon, lied across the tracks outside of a local station. They blocked trains in what they called a civil disobedience movement. A line of engineers also paraded on their bikes in Myanmar's capital, Naypyidaw. They held placards of detained de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi. The army denies its last Monday power seizure was a coup. It claims voter fraud in November's elections and says that it will hold a new vote. The military has increased its presence in major cities since the weekend and shut down the internet. The UN has warned the army of severe consequences for any harsh response to protesters. The Yemeni army has intensified its strikes targeting Saudi facilities in response to continued blockade and detention of oil ships by the Saudi-led coalition. The Ansarullah movement has warned that such attacks continue unless the war is stopped and the siege is lifted. Abdul Latif al-Washali has more from Sana'a.
The Yemeni army has struck Saudi facilities several times over the past week, with the Abha International Airport and an airbase in the kingdom's Asir province being the main target.
Weapons possessed by the Yemeni army today are capable of attacking any target deep inside the countries in the Saudi-led coalition. They must realize that the solution lies in stopping the aggression, lifting the siege on Yemenis, and not interfering in Yemeni affairs before the results become disastrous for them. These are warning messages and may be followed by larger operations.
The Ansarullah movement has time and again warned Riyadh and its allies that those operations are the result of Saudi Arabia's deadly aggression, as well as its illegal detention of oil vessels, which has exacerbated the humanitarian crisis in the country.
The Saudi-led coalition is responsible for the death and destruction. Their detention of oil ships and the blockade have had more disastrous effects than the war itself. Therefore, it is necessary to target Saudi facilities, and we will continue doing so until Saudi Arabia and the UAE stop the war and lift the siege.
The targeting of Saudi facilities coincides with the continuous advancement of the Yemeni army toward Marib, a city held by Saudi-backed forces in the north of Yemen.
Observers say Saudi Arabia and its allies are the ones who launched the war on Yemenis in 2015, and the Yemeni army has the right to target invaders in self-defense as well as pressure them to release oil vessels and end their blockade of the war-ravaged nation. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge. We are discussing about the qualities of the pious people. One of those qualities is the issue of avoiding gluttony, which we discussed about in the previous sessions. And today, inshallah, we will discuss certain dimensions that are to do with the physical, the material, the spiritual side effects of this attitude of gluttony. And inshallah, after that, we'll try to discuss about some of the methodologies of controlling gluttony. So basically, in the sessions in the previous sessions, we discussed about the material and the spiritual dimension of a human being, and how, if more attention is given to this material dimension, the spiritual dimension gets automatically ignored, and therefore can lead to problems. And we talked about the importance that Islam gives to the whole idea of eating food, and we discussed that eating in Islam, when we are told to avoid gluttony, we should have balance in it. That doesn't mean that you don't eat food at all. Of course, there has to be some balance. So inshallah, we will start today with some of the physical and the material effects of taking care of the food intake, especially avoiding gluttony.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, one of those benefits that we have is, for of course, which is very common, is the health, the physical health. Of course, this is also this issue of physical health has been told to us by the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam also. For example, one of the narrations say that the mother of all cures is to eat less. Eating less is the mother of all cures. Of course, if you look at what the scientists and the health experts tell us today, you will notice that this is very clear. The very fact that a lot of food is consumed means that much of that food material is either extra or it is harmful. And reducing that amount will definitely kick in some responses by the body that will keep it healthy. Another narration that we have is, for example, eating less causes a lot of the diseases to go away from the body. And of course, there are several narrations of this type. For example, one of the other narrations says that eating less means that disease becomes less in a person's body. There is also another narration that says that one who eats less, the amount of pain will also become less. And this is actually very clear, especially when you see when as a person grows in age, he should be even more careful about his diet, and especially about not eating too much, because of the fact that as age goes, the body becomes more of a place where very many different issues are just different material is just stored, because the metabolism becomes weaker, and you will notice that a lot of fat gets stored in the body, and some other chemicals that are harmful for the body also just get stored and are not released, and some are released without control. So all of these problems happen as age grows. So a person should realize that the way to reduce the amount of pain in the body is to control the amount of intake of food that they have. Another narration says that a person who eats less gives more value to himself, and his health will be continuous. So we see there's a very strong relationship here between continuous health and eating less.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Now, we have also another narration from Imam Ali alayhi salam, where he says that whoever suffices to eating less, his health will become more, and his intellect and his thinking capacity will also, you know, go towards perfection. And this is very clear, you know, especially because when a person eats a lot of food, there are many effects that happen to him, especially just in the onset when a person, for example, finishes eating a lot, when he fills his stomach completely. You will notice that even his breathing will reduce. A person who eats a lot, you know, the stomach is full, so the amount of breathing is less. The lungs do not get full capacity of oxygen. And this has detrimental effects in different ways. So you notice that a person's thinking capacity reduces. And therefore, even when a person eats a lot, the chances of getting angry very quickly, the chances of being able to think clearly reduce. All of these are there physically. So a person should keep all of these in mind also. We have another narration also that is there in Tuhaful Uqul, where Imam Ali alayhi salam says, the health of the body is actually from eating little food and little drink or little water. So eating and drinking, both of them here are stressed. In the previous narrations, it was more about eating. Now you told about drinking. Of course, all of these, keep in mind that you need to refer to a doctor also. Sometimes you're forced to drink a lot, for example, if you have a certain condition. But generally, reducing the amount of food intake and also the amount of water intake and different drinks is something that is encouraged in Islam. Or for example, in one of the other narrations, he says that the one who suffices, Imam Radha alayhi salam says, someone who suffices eating less, then his body will become healthy and firm and good. So basically we've seen that these are some of the physical effects, and inshallah, well, let's pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that by a simple action of just controlling food intake, we can have very healthy bodies and minds. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معناه باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد ممجد والفضل يمناه هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي ربا.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's episode, we're discussing The Reagan Show, directed by Pacho Velez and Sierra Pattingill. And joining me in this episode are Lee Singer, who is a film journalist and video essayist, whose work has appeared in various major newspapers, magazines, and online outlets. And beside him is Neil Faulkner, who is a historian, writer, and author, and has a new edition of his book coming out soon, which is called A Radical History of the World. Now, made up entirely of archive news and White House footage, The Reagan Show is a documentary that captures the pageantry, absurdity, and mastery of the made-for-TV politics of Ronald Reagan during his two terms in office as the 40th president of the US. This documentary shows how the former Hollywood actor redefined the look and feel of what it means to be in the highest office in the world, and also his rivalry with former Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev during the Cold War era.
The Reagan administration will be remembered for excelling in public relations.
I think that he has captured the imagination of the American people because of his ability to communicate.
To be prepared for war is one of the most effectual means of preserving the peace.
That's why New Hampshire needs John Sununu. Sununu.
Together, we'll make America great again.
I think appearance is very important, but it's also staging. It's how you stage the message.
Not for me, honey.
It's a game.
That's it.
Super!
Well, if you'll pardon my stealing a film line, the force is with us.
You have stated flatly that you did not trade weapons for hostages.
What began as a strategic opening to Iran deteriorated in its implementation.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
Happy New Year.
Thank you. God bless you.
Cut.
Take that, Mr. Gorbachev.
So first of all, thanks for coming on. Very much welcome to the show. And I found this documentary to be incredibly an eye-opening insight into the superficial sort of role of the president in the U.S. And also, I suppose this documentary comes at a fitting time as we see many parallels between Trump and Reagan. And Lee, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on this documentary?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating sort of behind-the-scenes look. It's got that inbuilt nostalgia factor. I mean, Reagan himself kind of very much based his own persona on this kind of, you know, folksy, you know, bygone era charms, you know, referring back to his Hollywood career before he was a politician. And the film, because it's got that sort of, you know, the videotape and the sort of grainy look and everything, it's almost an inbuilt kind of nostalgia trip for anyone who remembers him from that time. I think as a film, because it sort of sticks so closely to the sort of found footage and you know, commentary from the time, it allows viewers to make parallels. So, you know, in the trailer you see Reagan saying, "Make America great again," which obviously we have more modern connotations to today. But it doesn't give you that sort of perspective of people commenting back from now to then, and sort of maybe shaping a bit more the narrative of how we went from this sort of, you know, maybe more substance-driven thing to a more sort of style and, you know, pageantry and performance thing. So I understand why they've done it, and within the confines of the structure and the style that they use, it works. But there's a wider story that maybe would allow for more kind of, you know, nuance and reflection on how we got to that point.
But perhaps the onus of the documentary and the perspective is on the rest of the audience to figure out what's happening using the archive. You're forced to be guided through it, really, because without generation.
No, for sure. I mean, you know, it's very much, you know, it puts there and it's asking you, so, you know, how does that resonate today? And obviously there's a huge amount. It's like, you know, now it's Reagan on steroids, you know, because it's not just old style Hollywood production, it's social media, which is a whole different world, but reflects, you know, it's gone from that and it's sort of metastasized into something even more pernicious perhaps. Mm-hmm. But I still think that there's an element there that what I would love to see, and it's always, you know, you should never review the film that isn't made, but I would love to see him, how he went from actor to politician and used the media and the performance idea of that. It kind of starts, it's already fully formed, and we don't get a lot of analysis of how he became that, you know, ready-made image of a president.
So Neil, if I could bring you in here, there was a good point that Lee made. How did you find this documentary?
Well, I agree with everything that Lee has just said, and I think for me as a historian, the problem with it is, and as you say, we shouldn't be criticising the documentary that wasn't made, but the reality is that if you focus on the image, and the image was very, very powerful politically, it was very, very effective politically, because that avuncular, friendly, warm, genial, round-the-log-fire, all-American kind of image that was being very successfully promoted was a cover for a range of policies which were really quite pernicious. I mean, massive union busting operation going on, a driving down of wages, massive cuts to the poor, huge shifts in terms of tax cuts for the rich. So the poor were being penalised with benefit cuts while the rich were getting richer through the tax cuts, and this massive increase in military spending.
That's a really interesting point, and I want to delve into that issue a bit later on in the show.
We were riding to the airport yesterday afternoon, and my mother was talking about in Arkansas that they were trying to pass a law to give 150 or pay people standing in their homes instead of going to the old folks' home. I made the comment, I said, I didn't think we should give anything. I thought we should take care of our own, you know, that's my feelings. My little one, I thought, was asleep in the back seat, and he raised up and he said, "Granny, that's why Ronald Reagan's the president. Stop all these giveaway programs."
Tell me, you had the experience, Mr. President, at one time of auditioning for film roles, and then when you ran for governor and president, you were auditioning in front of the public for office. Which is more difficult?
Well, I have to say this one is. You have to, you not only have to get the part, you have to write the script.
And Neil, there's a moment in the documentary also that's quite revealing, and we see the mask slip a bit when we see that Reagan admits that it was actually easier to be an actor than it is to be a president. And he also says that he couldn't imagine being a president without being an actor also. What do you think the film implies then about the suitability of his character for president?
Well, I think to a very large extent anyway, the American president is very often a figurehead who's controlled by other forces. I mean, I don't think Reagan was particularly bright. I don't think he was particularly well informed. He's supposed to have had a reputation for being very impatient of detail. I don't think he was a particularly quick thinker, and so on. So I think we need to see him as, I mean, in a sense, the documentary's capturing this, isn't it? That he's the front man, he's the image, he's the folksy image, and the real hard policy is being decided by other people. And it was brutal policy, both domestically and in relation to what the US was doing internationally. So, yes, you could say the image is a construct, and he's quite a shallow figure, but hey, does that make any difference to the Reagan project actually being driven through by this administration? Because it was being driven through very effectively.
And Lee, what did you make of how this character, Reagan, was portrayed in this documentary?
Well, I mean, you know, I think with the best will in the world, even the biggest Ronald Reagan fans would not give him much credit as an actor. But he is uniquely suited for this sort of role because, as Neil says, there are he's got the best, you know, when he was a Hollywood actor, he never worked necessarily with the best filmmakers. When he's president, he's working with the very best people to stage and produce the theater that's going on. And he's got that sort of, I mean, you know, I watched this very carefully. I don't think there's a moment where he's not smiling, or at least he's not. He never looks unhappy. Mm-hmm. He's always got that kind of, the lights are on, you know, I'm on stage. You know, and you saw him in the clip before. He ushers people towards the mic. He's so aware of, you know, his role within the production. So he succeeds so much better as a president than he ever did as an actor, and that's fascinating to me because you would think one has a lot bigger stakes and is a lot, you know, you need a much better, you know, person at the job to succeed as president, but actually a sort of very average to mediocre actor can, you know, whether you agree with the policies or not, be a very successful president in terms of putting his message across.
That is really interesting, and we do learn that actually he's been in 53 Hollywood movies or so.
It's a film about Reagan's years in office and looking at those years through the lens of PR, and in particular how he used PR and public relations to fight the Cold War. By making a film that let you watch Reagan go from his roles in Hollywood eventually to the presidency, you'd sort of see how his work in Hollywood informed his performance as a politician. So I found this archive called the White House Television Archive that was commissioned and overseen by the Reagan administration. 2,000 hours of footage documenting Reagan's time in office. So Reagan was the subject of the archive, but he was also kind of its author. And as I'm making this film, sometimes I like to joke that Reagan's actually, in some ways, deserves a co-director credit.
So Neil, I just wanted to ask you to shed more political context on Reagan during the time. What was the political landscape like, and why was he elected?
I think there's a huge shift going on in the 1970s. The 1970s is a period of major crisis inside a lot of Western states, where there's a wave of radicalization, of union struggle, advances by social movements, and so on. And also internationally, US imperialism was on the back foot. In the 1970s, it suffered a series of very significant setbacks. The defeat in Vietnam, losing ground in Southern Africa, losing ground in Central Asia, losing ground in Central America as well, with the Nicaraguan Revolution at the end of the 1970s. And I think Reagan represents two things. He represents a kind of counterattack by the corporations and the rich inside America, against workers, against the poor, and against the social movements, and internationally, an attempt to reassert US imperial control over what is effectively an informal empire. They want to shore up US power at a time when the US economy is weakening, and that weakening of economic clout, which had been crucial to US power in the 50s and the 60s, to some degree you can compensate for that by substituting a more aggressive military stance. And I think that's what's happening under Reagan.
And in this documentary, you learn that he was called a trigger-happy president. Although he said he strived for peace, we saw sort of contradictions there.
Yes. No, that's absolutely right, because there's this massive, massive increase in arms expenditure, which brings it right up to the level that it was at the beginning of the Cold War in the early 1950s. And it creates a huge economic problem for the United States, a massive, massive budget deficit. I mean, all this stuff, you know, all this neoliberal stuff they're saying about how we need to control our budgets and we don't want big government, it's all nonsense. If you look at the military expenditure and the way it's being funded by borrowing, it has a crippling effect on the US economy in the long run. But what it does do is it breaks the back, this is the crucial thing, I think, of the Soviet Union. Because the Soviet Union, a much smaller economy and a failing economy, simply can't match these levels of arms expenditure. So you've got a second Cold War, which in a sense, Reagan wins by just upping the stakes to a level which the Soviets can't match.
That's really interesting. I want to pick up that point in the next part of the discussion, actually. And Lee, if I could ask you, did you see any similarities between Reagan and Trump? Because many critics are drawing many similarities between them and parallels.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that Trump would love to be, you know, as idolized as Reagan. And, you know, the whole Make America Great Again, which you hear Reagan say very early on in this documentary, you know, there's no, that's not a coincidence. He's trying to echo the sort of style. The difference is, and again, regardless if you agree with the policies, Reagan has a charm and a sort of, you know, acceptability to a large number of people. Trump obviously has a base. I mean, he won the election, even if he lost the popular vote. But it's kind of, you know, right-wing Republicanism with the mask off. It's the sort of the aggression and the kind of tit-for-tat stuff and the sort of intolerance which was, you know, largely covered by Reagan's, you know, kind of charm and sort of, you know, persona. That's all gone. And what's interesting now is it's like you don't even need that cover, it seems, at the moment to kind of succeed. And that's quite a sort of fairly terrifying development, I would say.
Indeed, and critics say that Reagan set the precedent for today's facts don't matter politics. And critics also say that Trump sort of coined this fake news sort of propaganda and techniques from the Reagan era. And we heard in the documentary, actually, that Reagan was aware of the frenzy he would cause with the media just to be able to dodge questions, so to speak. So do you think that there are similarities between the two?
Yeah, but and we must be careful. I mean, fake news is a current term, but politicians have always lied, especially when they're defending a vested interest. They've always lied to the people, so we need to be quite careful. That's the old word, really, for fake news, in a sense. But I think it is true. There's been a ramping up of that. And Reagan starts it, and it's now at an absolutely epidemic level, I think, with Trump and with the Tory government in Britain as well. We've actually got to a point where lying has become, fake news if you like, lying seems to have become pretty much systematic and institutionalized. So politicians are completely routinely saying the opposite to the public of what is actually happening behind the scenes. And it's there with Reagan, because everything Reagan is saying about, you know, this is a struggle between right and wrong, this is a crusade for freedom, Russia is the evil empire, all of this kind of stuff, this Cold War rhetoric that's being pumped out, is hiding, I mean, terrible atrocities and injustices which are being perpetrated by American imperialism.
I'll have to pause you there. We will pick up that more in the next part.
Gorbachev seems to be most confident that he can outperform Ronald Reagan. He's feeling comfortable, he's feeling good about the way things are going, and he thinks that he should be able to strut his stuff as well on the world stage.
It is Gorbachev who is very vocal with the press, talking, right, laughing, smiling. It is Mr. Reagan who is sitting back, speaking monosyllabically. Now, why isn't Mr. Reagan coming forward in the way that we've seen him in the past?
Gorbachev is trying to win through public opinion what he doesn't necessarily get at the negotiating table. If he can gain leverage against the United States through his propaganda efforts, then he can win something at the table.
And so the stage is set for Mr. Reagan and Gorbachev to report on their summit, with every indication they will call it a success. But behind all the smiles and rhetoric, the question is whether they have really done something to make the world breathe easier.
So we see a lot of Gorbachev featuring in this documentary, and I think he's portrayed in a more charismatic light, and he seems to come across as a more bold leader than Reagan from the media clips that we've seen in this film. Lee, can I ask you, what did you make of their rivalry and how the, Gorbachev was portrayed?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the film is The Reagan Show, and it obviously concentrates on Reagan, but Gorbachev becomes a major player within the film because it kind of builds, you know, the Cold War as the overarching narrative for it. He comes across as incredibly charismatic and very intelligent, and I think what you see is there's a section where they show that actually the Russians or Soviet Union hire an American PR firm to help with their own promotion and, you know, marketing effectively. So it's very clear that I think the other thing we have to be really careful is this is not just an American or a Western thing, this performance thing. Every country indulges in this. Every nation, you know, distorts the views that they need to sort of, you know, win the public opinion and stuff. It's not just the States. It's not just the West. And you see how the Soviet Union becomes very adept very quickly. And it's also got a very media savvy figurehead who can basically go toe to toe with Ronald Reagan. And, you know, I think as much as Reagan obviously, you know, had a big part in play in the Cold War, I think you underestimate Gorbachev's role also doing that, whether it's only because, you know, the Soviet Union couldn't afford an arms race, but I think, you know, you could also look at it in a positive way and say, yes, there's also an impetus to try and break this kind of escalation that's going on.
That is a good point, actually. It does make you think, this documentary, about how intertwined the media and politics are. And Neil, I just wanted to quickly touch on how Star Wars was introduced in this documentary, and was seen as actually not existing, and it was a PR stunt to bring the Russians to the negotiating table. How accurate is this?
I think the Star Wars initiative was very, very real. I mean, I think this is why it's true to call it the Second Cold War, because if the US had developed a technology to shoot missiles down from space, the effect would have been that the mutually assured destruction, which had basically acted as a mutual deterrent, would suddenly have gone. The Russians were genuinely very, very frightened by this development and couldn't match it. They didn't have the technology and they didn't have the economic resources. And I think that that is a stick with which to beat Gorbachev. You see, I think Gorbachev was actually a more serious political player than Reagan. I think he really was driving it. I mean, what you see actually on the screen with Gorbachev is real. He's the young reformer who really is trying to transform the Soviet Union. And behind the scenes, what's actually happening is Reagan and his advisors are not giving much ground at all, particularly on Star Wars. And it's actually the Russians who make all of the concessions because they're so desperate.
Yes, we do see it, especially from this documentary, that the Americans are on the back foot. And so the final 20 seconds to you, Lee, as we're running out of time, would you recommend this documentary?
I would. I mean, it's a fascinating look at, you know, an era that really where video and, you know, the performance aspect came to power. You could argue that, you know, this is not, it didn't start with Reagan. You think of Kennedy and Nixon and the TV debates that people thought, yeah, TV Kennedy won and radio thought Nixon won. But, it shows that it got ramped up at this moment and it had a Hollywood actor. So it's kind of a perfect, you know, Hollywood movie. You know, the medium becomes the message, basically.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. I'm afraid we've run out of time. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambiati.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.